So it's been wonderful to be here this week. I've learned a heck of a lot. I want to thank organizers of both workshops, and in particular one organizer who kindly gave us a tutorial on black hole information. So this interplay between string and condensed matter and so on is wonderful. So a few years back, I learned that one of the deepest questions in string theory, which Joe Polchinski has thought a lot about, is what is string theory? And as part of this ongoing interplay, I learned that I knew how to work out the answer. So the answer, the key to the answer, the framework for the answer was supplied by the director of this institute, who took on the more general task of answering the question, what is physics? He said, physics is what physicists do. So another point of interplay is that a few months back, another KATP permanent member, Leon Valence, wrote a seminal paper on 5D post-perovskite oxides, which was discussing with some colleagues. And one of my stringy friends walked by and was really excited. So condensed matter people were also interested in 5D models. Okay, all the serious stuff. Yesterday, at least several of you were here for this beautiful talk by Steve Kibbleson, which I personally thought was perhaps the best presented case for the ubiquity of bad metals, known from liquid metals and correlated many electron metals. So it's increasingly commonly seen, typically, in materials where the active electrons come from atomic d or f orbitals. So Steve gave a large number of examples, which I'm not going to list again. There are far too many. So the question that I'm trying to address in this talk, and was encouraged or rather forced by the organizers to address that question, is to give some thoughts on how we might go about making progress in the problem that Steve defined so nicely for us. Right? So I'm not going to give a solution because I don't have a solution. I don't know that anyone has a solution. But really, what I'd like to do in this talk is to think about some directions that one might explore, think a lot about some directions that one might explore, point out some difficulties and some simple things that one might try, and talk about at least one idea that I think has a lot of promise, but it's not been developed fully yet because it's very hot. Right? So hopefully that'll be useful, generally in thinking about how to get ahead in this problem. Okay, so we need a strategy. But the first and crucial question that I think is good to ask is something that I again stole from Leon. I keep stealing things from Leon. There's this wonderful phrase, whether these growing number of examples that we have of non-Fermi liquid physics, whether they're all the same kind of non-Fermi liquid, or whether there's different mechanisms at play in these different materials, and we have to think about them differently. Right? We should at least post this question, and I don't know the answer to this question. Right? I've given an opinion, but I don't know the answer. And since we don't know what's causing non-Fermi liquid physics, we don't understand it, we might actually keep an open mind on the answer to this question. Okay? So in other words, so in searching for a theory of this kind of thing, we can either search for a theory of everything non-Fermi liquid, but that's hard. So maybe we should at least try for a theory of something non-Fermi liquid. Right? Okay. So let's do some, let's make some common sense decisions. I think all of you agree are reasonable things to do. So let's focus on a few best characterized examples and try to see if we can think sensibly about these. So let's look for systems for which, the electrical resistivity is a good thing to measure, it's an easy thing to measure, as Steve discussed at length, but where we hopefully know much more than just the electrical resistivity of the material. Right? That can't hurt. And it's definitely going to help, right? And the non-Fermi liquid extends over a wide range of energy scales. So if you think, this is a theory institute, if you think in terms of some more G flow, that you come close enough to this putative non-formulaic fixed point, and it is not just vaguely, your OG flow is not vaguely curving towards it. You're not in some crossover regime. You need some wide, it's good if it comes close enough to it, so there's a wide range of energy scales with the phenomenon is seen. And ideally, we'd also like the microscopic physics of this system to be simple enough that we have some hope of modeling it. But that may be too much to ask for, because these are all fairly complicated materials. But if we can do that, that's good. Fortunately, there are a few such systems, and I'm basically going to restrict attention only to those few systems. And even more fortunately, the first example that I'll put up for such a system is also the most notorious, the one that everyone here is familiar with, the HITC, normal state, strange, bad, whatever adjective you want to put in it. So I think enough people have discussed the weird properties of this state in this week that I don't need to emphasize it very much again. There's also this pseudo-gap regime, which is also weird and is not understood. So these are some of the issues that one would like to understand in the qubits, right? But let me give you a second example, which at least I have found extremely useful to think about in my own thinking, and that is magnetic ordering, the vicinity of magnetic ordering in certain rare earth alloys. So rare earths are these things that live outside of the periodic table at the bottom. it has an F associated with it, so it's not an extra dimension. Let me just give you a 30-second summary of the essential microscopic properties of these materials, which is important. They all have partially filled F orbitals that form localized magnetic moments, right? And that's important. So the model to describe these would be some sort of model of local magnetic moments that are coupled to a separate band of conduction electrons through magnetic exchange. So when I made this slide, I assumed that the word condo may not be familiar to many ADS people, but John McGreevy told me that everyone knows condo. So that's what's known as the condo lattice. Sorry? He said some people know condo. Okay. So we don't know what condo is. This is condo. What I've described there. So a number of such materials have been studied over the last several, maybe 15, 20 years. So these are listed here. And in fact, this particular material was first, this kind of phase diagram was explored in this material by Gil Londrich, who's in the audience. So what's typically seen is that as you tune some parameter, it could be pressure, it could be substituting one element with another element. You go from a phase which is an antiferromagnetic metal to some other phase which has lost the magnetism and is a permiliquid metal, as far as one can tell. And there's a regime of non-permiliquid physics that appears somewhere in this region. Okay. And this system, I put this up because it's extremely well studied through a variety of different probes and definitely qualifies as something where more than just the resistivity is known, right? And it also qualifies for the second point that there's non-formulated physics over a wide range of energy scales. Microscopic modeling is very complicated, but the one aspect of microscopic physics which is simple is that the F orbital is clearly localized, at least in these materials, and forms a magnetic moment. Right? There are other bands which are extremely complicated, but the accepted story for these materials is that this is the essential, zeroth order picture one must have of how to think about what microscopically is going on.
Are two-dimensional?
These are all three-dimensional. They may be slightly anisotropic, but they are good three-dimensional materials. In some cases, there's some anisotropy, but it's not like the cube plates or anything. Okay. So clearly, in these two cases, there's a roughly common phase diagram where there's a phase A, there's a phase B, there's non-foamy liquid physics over some region here. Perhaps something else happens in between, like in the cube plates. That's it, right? And this kind of phase diagram you've seen in many talks this week, it's fairly common. I want to emphasize that though this kind of phase diagram is very common, and non-foamy liquid physics frequently occurs in this way in the phase diagram, the other possibility, where it extends all the way down to zero temperature and forms a non-foamy liquid phase, is actually somewhat less common. So reasonably stable non-foamy liquid phases at T equals zero, there are very few examples of that, which at some levels makes the life of a theorist harder, because the phase is always easier to describe than some regime at some intermediate scales. As far as I know, there's only one material, this beta ytterbium aluminium boron 4, which seems quite seriously to be in a non-foamy liquid phase at zero temperature. There are indications of that in other, the so-called heavy fermion metals, the kind of rare earth alloys I was talking about earlier. And maybe also in the material that Gil Rotheridge talked about earlier today, MNSI.
What properties are non-foamy liquid like?
In which material?
The first one, say.
Oh, it's the first one, for instance, specific heat or the spin susceptibility, the electrical resistivity, you know, all of them.
Is it linear, something else?
It's sort of linear, that's right. The spin and the specific heat is a T log T.
Over the whole range.
Yeah, so at least as a function of pressure, this material is kind of interesting and weird. As a function of pressure, there's a whole range. But the moment you apply a magnetic field, it seems to revert back to Fermi liquid. So for the topological insulator people, this may be a time reversal protected non-Fermi liquid. that's the empirical statement. Okay.
And this is applicable to
what goes to blue? So dmdh goes like, I believe goes like 1 over root t, but one thing that I don't know, I don't know what to make of this, that these occur only rarely. Is this a statement about physics, or is this a statement about where we are in history in our exploration of materials? It may well be that 20 years from now, people will say, you know, look, we found all these 100 examples of this thing, and this is the common thing. We don't know, right? But for now, this is more common than this, right? So I'm going to restrict myself to maximize one's chances of making contact with experiments to try to describe this kind of non-foamy liquid rather than this kind of non-foamy liquid. So what we are after is trying to understand unstable non-foamy liquid, right? Something that's hard to stabilize to zero temperature. So how do we think about unstable intermediate energy scale non-foamy liquid regimes? So that's the question that I'll try and address. I don't know how to think about it, but I'll tell you what I think. So in trying to think about this, it's useful to distinguish, to categorize one's thinking into two different, qualitatively different categories of states. So one thing, this again is a useful example of an interplay between ADS and CMT. I've learned to put semi in front of lots of different things. It's, I think, a cool way to capture what we may be talking about. So one kind of intermediate energy state would be what I call a semi-quantum non-Fermi liquid regime. So this is a non-Fermi liquid which is necessarily unstable at low temperature, and no finite amount of tuning can stabilize such a state at zero temperature. Right? So it does not correspond to the ground state behavior with any finite amount of tuning. And indeed, one way to think about a theory of such a regime is that this is a theory that needs an IR completion. Right? So it doesn't make sense in IR without some other physics intervening. Okay? I think that language the atheist people understand. Now the other kind is where this intermediate temperature regime is controlled by the approach to a finitely unstable zero temperature fixed point. So it's really a quantum regime, not semi-quantum, it's just quantum. Okay? And it's an approach to a quantum fixed point. If we have a description of such a zero temperature fixed point, we can then start calculating things at finite temperature, at least in principle. Okay, so let me give you some examples of these. So John McGreevy, at the end of his marathon two-hour talk, mentioned a few of these yesterday, since not all of you might have been there, let me put this list up again. So the classic example is a metal at a temperature above the Debye temperature, right? So where the photons are classical, but the electrons are quantum, right? So that clearly, you know, we should call it semi-quantum. And we know that the relativity is linear in temperature and all kinds of things happen in this regime. So this clearly cannot be stabilized all the way down to zero temperature. You know, it has finite entropy and so on. So this model of classical phonons with quantum electrons can be generalized to a number of other collective bosonic fluctuations. It could be replaced phonons with antiferromagnetic spin fluctuations or some emergent gauge field and so on. And those are all qualitatively similar. Right? Things that are only stable at some intermediate finite temperature. So not really described by quantum zero temperature fixed points with any finite amount of tuning. If you wish to use that language, there's an infinite number of relevant perturbations for the zero temperature fixed point. So a very nice example, known in the kinetic spiral literature as a spin incoherent metal, where you're in a regime of interactions and density of electrons, which is such that the spin physics is completely incoherent. The spins are flipping back and forth. Your temperatures are above some energy scale that characterizes spin exchange between the electrons, but where the charge motion is still quantum. Right? So this kind of regime occurs quite naturally in a one-dimensional electron gas at low density, and was studied in several papers a few years back. I think Leon Balance wrote a very nice paper on this, which I messed up while I was trying to teach it at some point. But there's a very developed theory of these 1D spin incoherent Leidinger liquids. And these are states in which there's a spin entropy of log 2 per particle, right? But the charge motion is quantum, and there's all kinds of weird physics in this regime. It's, you know, 1D, you're never going to get, you always get a non Fermi liquid. So getting a non Fermi liquid in 1D is not a big deal. So the big deal in 1D is to try to find a non Leidinger liquid. And so this is an example of a non Leidinger liquid in 1D. So all of these things exist. Right? Yeah?
Just a, sort of a philosophy question. In your semi-quantum case.
Yeah, this is semi-quantum.
Yeah. So yeah. If there's an infinite number of relevant operators, you might have thought it would be very hard even to find it as an intermediate regime that's governed by this fixed point. So the infinite number of relevant operators should just be marginally relevant? Why does the fixed point ever?
No, so let's take this example where we understand, right? So zero temperature, you know, it's a very sick thing. It's immediately unstable. Right? But we still know that there is a finite energy scale. So the way in which this degeneracy of these phonon states is lifted, it's lifted in some particular, so phonons have some band. So you go above that phonon band width.
So in the RG language, why are you approaching a fixed point when it's...
Because it's very specific perturbation that microscopically exists in the system. You know, it's a spring model for whatever. So given that these things exist, and so then one immediate question to pose about the experiments in this restricted class of system that I said I'll focus on is whether they are in such a regime, right? Or is the cupid strange metal a semi-quantum non-Fermi liquid? What about the heavy fermion materials? And you might form a serious opinion on the answer to this question by asking in the experiments whether the non-Fermi liquid extends to energy scales that are much, much lower than the microscopic energy scales. Right? So if that is true, it seems hard to understand why it is so if it's really a state that can't be stabilized to zero temperature. So let's think about the qubits. So in a popular model of the qubits, the TJ model, is a J, which is the microscopic exchange, magnetic exchange, that's on the order of 1500 Kelvin. It's about 130 to 145 millielectron volts. The hopping of the electrons is, people believe it's about three times this number. So that's the sort of rough energy scale to have in mind in the qubits. And let's look at the resistivity, which everyone's seen a zillion times. This famous linear resistivity goes down all the way down to 10 Kelvin in this material, this code 2201. This is a very famous paper from ancient times. 10 Kelvin is much, much smaller than these microscopic scales, so one worries that maybe it's not in the spin, semi-quantum regime. Now, more recently, people have in a number of different qubit materials applied a magnetic field to suppress the supercritical transition temperature to zero, and in some such cases, the linear resistivity essentially continues all the way down to the lowest measured temperatures of maybe about 1 Kelvin or so. Yeah. Yes.
That you don't believe that.
No, I believe the data.
No, but that it actually is the same thing that stands on the other hand. But okay, never mind.
Around this optimal doping, this is the same thing that extends all the way up. It's only when you go slightly away towards this overdoped side that there's dispute between the two experimentalists on whether there's a low temperature linearity and a high temperature linearity. I think if you just look at the data, at some, I forget, 18% or 19%.
This will change as you change the doping a little bit,
as you go into this overdope thing, I wasn't going to comment really on this wiggle at low, this thing that Steve mentioned in his talk, because it, if people really want me to discuss that, I can discuss it for a few minutes, because there are other facts that we know about the overdoped qubit which are pertinent to that discussion.
Okay, let me make my other point.
Yeah.
So we certainly know examples where this semi-quantum thing is stable down to some hierarchically small temperature compared to the microscopic scale.
Yeah, so like in a super frustrated magnet or something. Yeah, so we have to invent some physics to explain why the scale is so low.
But then you would also, you would have seen that
entropy and exactly.
Just too much entropy.
That's right. So there'll be other signatures of things of that sort.
This is obviously in Shamit's question just before, right? I mean, that there shouldn't be an intermediate regime, right? At the UV scale, the infinitely many perturbations, you're just going to get nothing straight away.
That was my question.
And I think that's what you're saying. The fact that you have this regime means that it's not semi-quantum.
That's what
I always said, unless you tune it.
I think the answer to your question is that all of these operators are small, not because of scaling, just because of the ratio of the mass of the electron to the mass of the ion.
In the phonon case, that's indeed the story.
But indeed, the reason you don't expect it to persist down to hierarchically low temperatures is because there's no other small parameter.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So John would like there to be an emergent small parameter. At least it points out that there are situations in which there's an emergent small parameter, and that's true. But as Steve says, frustrated magnet or something, that would push entropy down to low temperatures, and there's no evidence of that happening. So it seems as though many aspects of the observed non-Fermi liquid in the qubit is unlikely to be semi-quantum. And the same story goes for the heavy Fermi on non-Fermi liquid, but I'm not going to show or discuss the data here. Okay, so let's move on to the other possibility that we are dealing with a quantum T equals zero non-Fermi liquid fixed point, and let's see how we might try to think about that. So it's useful to keep in mind an OG point of view and think about an OG flow diagram, for instance, in the qubits, but we could do this in the fermion system as well. So when you have a phase diagram like this, right? So as you come down in temperature, think energy scale, you're going through this non-Fermi liquid regime, and then depending on where you are, you may go into the supercritical curve, or you may go into, if you're on this side, you're going to phase A, or on this side, you're going to phase B. So it's natural to use as a language, an OG language, in which you say that as you coarse grain down, come down in energy scale, that you're approaching a strange metal fixed point, and that you veer away from it. In the case of the cube plates, to the left, you go into something that you might, the pseudo gap regime, and you might have some description of it in terms of in an OG language, which is probably complicated. On the other side, in the overdose side, if you veer to the right, that you go away from the strange metal fixed point towards the Fermi liquid fixed point, and that all of these fixed points have some level of instability towards the D-wave superconductor. Okay? So then, the way to think about the strange metal region in the cube plates would be to say, I want to find a description, a theoretical description of this fixed point. It's a zero temperature quantum fixed point with a small number of relevant perturbations, maybe one towards the superconductor and one that takes it either to the Fermi liquid or the pseudo gap. Right? So at least two relevant perturbations, maybe three, but a finite number. Right? And we want to know whether we can describe such a fixed point. So such an unstable fixed point clearly also controls the putative quantum phase transition between phases A and phases B. Right? In OG language, that's how we think about critical fixed points. Right? So this is one natural reason to try and associate a quantum unstable zero temperature fixed point with this entire idea of quantum criticality. Okay, that's quantum multi-criticality, but nevertheless, so this observation that the same fixed point controls the curvature quantum phase transition, that tells us how to describe the phase transition. So we turn this observation around backwards, and we say that perhaps whatever causes the phase transition between A and B is also what's giving us the non-Fermi liquid physics. And if you know how to describe phase transitions, we have a description of the same metal fixed point. We might be tempted to say that. So the natural assumptions that one would make on the base of this line of thought, it might seem, but to say that the non-Fermi liquid is the universal physics associated with this curvature quantum critical point between phases A and B. And Landau told us how to think about quantum critical points, or any critical point, as universal critical singularities, or the fluctuations of the order parameter that describe the transition from A to B. Then we try to use Landau's ideas on phase transitions to kill Landau's ideas on Fermi liquid. Right? So this line of thought would then tell us that we should attempt to describe the non-Fermi liquid in terms of a theoretical, a low energy effective theory, where we start with the Fermi surface of the Fermi liquid and then build in whatever order is building up on the other side. Say in the heavy fermion context, it would be the antiferromagnetic order. And we build up a theory as Fermi surface plus X, where X is the gapless order parameter fluctuations. Right? The heavy fermion context would be the antiferromagnetic spin fluctuations, which are going critical at the transition. Okay. So one immediately runs into serious problems with this idea. So quantum criticality, it's not really clear whether formulated this way is going to save us or whether it's going to be a distraction. So this sort of naive invocation of quantum criticality to construct the theory of this non-Fermi liquid fixed point has serious problems. And experimentally, the best case for this is, can be made in the heavy fermion metals. That's one of the reasons why the heavy fermion metals are useful, is I find them useful to think about. So these are three-dimensional materials, as Matthew correctly wanted me to clarify. The theory of critical antiferromagnetic spin fluctuations coupled to a Fermi surface in three dimensions is well developed. People have been thinking about it for a long time. And even Max Metlitsky approves their treatment. Is that right? Yeah, good. So it survived Max, so it must be right. And so what this theory predicts is only very, very weak departures, maybe not very, very weak. It predicts weak departures from Fermi liquid theory, which are spectacularly inconsistent with all the phenomena that we know happen in these materials. For instance, relativity is not linear temperature, though it is an experiment. The experiment shows nice scaling of the spin fluctuation spectrum as measured in neutron scattering in one of these materials. And the theory is such that you should not expect such scaling, and so on. This is enough problems that this not this well-developed theory is not our answer. Right?
So,
yeah.
Here, are you talking about examples where the Fermi surface is the same on the two sides?
Or? We'll come to that. These are natural assumptions, and we'll see. We'll have to re-examine these natural assumptions. So what about the cuprates, right? So the cuprates...
Just to make sure I understand, it's yeah. Well developed because you're up above the crypto.
Exactly, that's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah.
One more question, just in this class of materials,
yeah.
You sometimes get NFLs with different scales of resistivity of the temperature, it's not always linear.
It's not always linear,
so,
that's
so
right.
Then you actually have to hypothesize there's more than just this one critical point of anti-ferromagnetic spin fluctuations. There have to be more.
Yes, that's indeed correct. In fact, some of these are presumably of this form. So the specific ones that I've chosen to talk about are the ones that are not of this form.
I guess this morning we saw some plots
of the 5/3 for the ferromagnetic. That's absolutely correct. Yeah. Right, so what about the cuprates? You know, do we have a candidate theory of this general nature that we can turn the crank on? The experimenters, the cuprates, have been super kind to us in that they made our problems much worse by giving us far too many examples of broken symmetry orders in this, the gene, Zundertoft gene. So the Overdorf cuprate has no broken symmetry except for the superconductor.
As far as we know yet.
That's right. Well, the Underdog cuprate, of course, has the superconductor, but it has almost, I think one could almost make it, write down a theorem saying that every symmetry that these materials have is broken, and as Matthew pointed out to me, they even break some symmetries that they don't have. Like pneumatic order in YBCO, for instance. So there's antiferromagnetism that's seen as static antiferromagnetism in some material, there's types, there's pneumatic orders that are seen increasingly frequently. Broken time reversal has been reported 3 years, 4 years back, something like that. Even weirder orders have been reported with extreme confidence by the experimentalists. Things that break time reversal and rotation, but preserve some combination and leave translation symmetries unbroken. Right? So there's a large number of order parameters to play with, and perhaps one would get lucky by picking exactly the right one and constructing a theory of the sort of Fermi surface plus the right kind of X. Right? Could any of these give rise to the strange method? Okay. So here, one can appeal to experiment of a different sort to at least point out the difficulty with this program of finding the right X to couple the Fermi surface to produce the, all the interesting non-Fermi liquid physics. So some of the non-Fermi liquid physics in the cuprates extends to very high energy scale. So the same plot that I used to show that the things happen to very low temperature shows that the same thing also happens to very high temperature. Right? And Steve gave a number of beautiful examples of this kind of thing, some of which were in the cuprates yesterday. So I also want to point out another experiment that GADM has made an appearance in several ADS talks this week. I think Sean certainly mentioned it, and Eva mentioned it. So this is a measurement of the optical conductivity of nearly optimally doped cuprate, probably exactly optimally doped, as a function of frequency. And there's a power law at high frequencies, which is roughly 1 over omega to the 2/3, something like that. Now the thing to point out is that this scale is in electron volts, right? And this power law behavior, you know, basically extends all the way up to at least an EV. We don't know what happens beyond that, but I think you run into absorption by other junk. Okay? Even if you don't believe that you can fit this to a power law, you know, this range, you know, half an EV, and all the excess that you can think of are emergent bosonic collective fluctuations, which they'll have a hard time giving you this kind of universal physics, all, you know, at scales comparable to the bandwidth of these materials, right? So, so this low energy Fermi surface plus X thing has a difficulty with the UV scale, while the semi-quantum has a difficulty with the IR scale, right? Now, there's an interesting theoretical problem here, because this way I mentioned Max earlier. The theory for the onset of some of these orders, you know, it's fine about the experiment. Let's just ask, do we understand the theory? And it turns out the theory is sort of interesting and not understood. And this was realized only fairly recently, and Max has made a heroic attempt to try and understand, or at least to try and show that we don't understand these kinds of critical points. So there's an interesting theoretical problem, but one has to keep in mind that in applying this to at least the cuprates, there are all kinds of difficulties. Right? But this problem is going to arise in other materials, in other contexts, so it's an important problem to solve if people can solve it. Right? But at least for the cuprates, no, there are issues with. If you think you'll understand cuprates by solving this, no. That may be a bit too optimistic, even for EDS. Okay. This ninth quantum critical point of view is problematic. But you know, this OG perspective is clearly reasonable, and that's presumably right. And you can think of it as more or less a rewrite of the phase diagram. So within this OG perspective, perhaps we have to say that the, you know, this OG perspective is fine, but concluding that we can build a theory of this interesting fixed point, just as critical fluctuations associated with the onset of order in this metal, that that's the wrong statement. That's, you know, we need a more sophisticated view of what happens at this phase transition, and perhaps that will be the, that will, you know, get us out of these problems. So what we have in pursuing this line of thought is that, you know, everything we know fails. Fermi liquid theory, theory of phase transitions, and all of this, that's a problem, right? Okay. So what I want to spend the rest of the talk about is one idea that has emerged in the last few years. You know, combination of theory and experiments, but really being taken seriously only because of experiments, which have perhaps have provided us with a clue on how we might go about doing something about this problem in light of the difficulty with all the other things that we've tried to do. Right? So I'm going to talk about this clue from experiments and tell you to what extent we can build on this clue to do something. Turns out we can't do much, but at least it's probably in the right direction. So it turns out that some of these zero temperature phase transitions in metals, what happens is not just an onset of order, but that the entire Fermi surface or an entire Fermi surface sheet of the metal can just disappear. Right? So it's not just a simple onset of order, but something else that is not captured by an order parameter, by Landau order parameter, has happened. It's that you've lost a Fermi surface. Right? So an example that I'll show one piece of data about is the onset of magnetism in these rare-earth alloys, these silicon fermion materials. A simpler conceptual example is the transition from a metal to a Mohr translator. I'll discuss that a bit more. And the high TC cube rate is a function of doping as you go from the overdoped side to the underdoped side. Something dramatic is happening to the electronic structure that is not completely understood empirically. But one thing that I think we know with some confidence is that we are at least doing enormous damage to the Fermi surface of the metal. So,
changing sides counts as disappearing or not?
Yeah. I'll talk about it. So, if any of these transitions is second order, you know, then non-Fermi liquid is very natural, right? You're about to lose your Fermi surface, so the Fermi surface must have some weird fluctuation, you know, something must be going on, right? And clearly, more is going on than just the order parameter turning on, right? So, physics clearly beyond, you know, what Landau told us. You know, look at the order parameter and let it fluctuate, and that's it. So a nice example of this kind of thing is in one of these heavy fermion systems, which also Gil mentioned earlier today, cesium, rhodium, indium 5. So this axis plots the De Haas and Allison frequencies, which measure these extremal areas of the Fermi surface. So let me tell you that this material is an ordered antiferromagnetic metal, which loses its antiferromagnetism at a temperature which in zero field is around this pressure. It's about 2-point-something gigapascals. And beyond that, it's a paramagnetic metal. Right? So that's a magnetic phase transition. So this carries geometric information about the size of the Fermi surface. And so you see a bunch of frequencies, which more or less don't change as a function of pressure. That's a new structure that appears here, which I'm told is related to some magnetic, some change in the magnetic structure of the material. And as you go through the magnetic phase transition, there's an entire new set of frequencies that appear. Okay? So it looks as though entire sheets of the Fermi surface are disappearing right at the phase transition. Now this might look like it's a first order transition, but there's the same experiment gives you another interesting piece of information. From this experiment, you can determine the effective mass of the electron as it does its orbit. And this effective mass seems to diverge, coming from both sides. It's weaker here, but stronger on this side.
What are all those black dots?
Yeah, so there's some new frequencies that appear, which the experiment, let's say, is related to a change in the magnetic structure that happens at exactly this pressure.
There's another transition
in the magnetic structure, uh-huh. Which is, yeah.
So these De Haas van Alphen frequencies become fuzzier and fuzzier as you approach the transition.
Yeah, the mass is getting bigger, that's right. Yeah. So the amplitude goes down.
Is it just because we have for the pockets in the...
No, okay, so that's a good question. So when you have magnetic long range order, you change the unit cell of the solid, and so you will anyway change the Fermi surface a bit. Now you can ask, so how do you really compare these two things? So what the experimentalists did was to notice that you can basically reproduce these set of frequencies if you take an analogous material where instead of cesium you have lanthanum. So lanthanum, rhodium, indium 5. The lanthanum doesn't have this lone F electron, it's an F0. And then you fold, if you fold that remaining structure, then you reproduce exactly these sort of orbits. Right? So as I'll mention in the next slide, what's going on here is not just folding, but you're also losing that electron from the Fermi surface. Okay.
A question.
Yeah.
And a magnetic order parameter is a second order phase transition.
Yeah, so the nail temperature looks like it's dropping. Now, at zero field, as we saw earlier today, there's superconducting transitions. This is really a fortunate material because you apply the field, You kill the super entropy and you can study the normal state down to the temperature. So it looks as though what we are dealing with is a situation where the non-Fermi liquid may be due to fluctuations that are different from the natural order parameter. If you look at the phase diagram, you say, look, there's an order parameter turning on, right? If you didn't know much else. But quite possibly what we're learning is that there are other things going on which perhaps are much more important than the magnetism.
Just one question. So when you're doing the Dehaus diagram, can't you go through the non-Fermi liquid? And is it a temperature?
Goes to
the slightly.
Yeah, this is the data, right? So you can. So I don't know exactly what happens at that critical field if you look at the data. So the more basic point one wants to make is that, so in these rare earth colors, these heavy fermion systems, I said that microscopically they have F moments, an F band which is localized and form local moments. Now it's been known for many decades that the theory of the metallic state, the Fermi liquid state, is such that these local moments should be counted as part of the Fermi C, that they dissolve into the Fermi C through the Kondo process, which someone apparently knows. So they should be counted as part of the Fermi C to satisfy Luttinger's sum rule. Right? Now on this side, on the other hand, the local moments apparently just talk to each other and freeze out and form antiferromagnetic order, and then there's no further need for, there's no Kondo. Right? They're just frozen by talking to each other, and that's it. Right? So various people have suggested, and Kathleen Pepper is one of them, she's here, had suggested even before this experiment that this kind of thing may be going on in these materials, and that the non-Fermi liquid physics is at least in part due to the fluctuations of the loss of these local moments from the Fermi C, right? Which is not captured by this natural order parameter that is turning on. Right? In fact, one might even go further and wonder if the entire magnetic ordering is a total distraction, and that really the only important thing that's going on, well, not the only important, main important thing that's going on is this change of the electronic structure. So there are a large number of questions about this kind of transition for which we don't know the answer at all. Could this be a second order transition where the this change of whether the F moment is part of the Fermi surface or not happens at exactly the same time as a magnetic phase transition? How do we describe such a phase transition? Will it reproduce the observed non-Fermi liquid physics? We don't know. But if this is going on, it's hard to imagine that one can interpret experiments on these materials without taking this into account. Yeah.
Are there examples where the Fermi surface volume jumps, but there is no magnetic order on either side?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. There are claimed examples, but very recently, it's one of those things that made it to my list of this less common phase diagram, ytterbium, rhodium, silicide, where rhodium is, put in iridium for rhodium. There's a claim that that happens.
It's not only a claim, no, I think.
No, it's probably true, but it's better to be conservative, I think. You know, because it'd be an enormously exciting thing if that were to be found.
That would just be a coincidence that the magnetic order happens at the same point.
Yes, that's indeed correct. If that's the generic case. But finding such a phase would be really exciting. We should all be jumping up and down. So it's better to be conservative about whether it's been found or not. I think that's all I want to say.
Actually, I quickly agree with your strong statement that when the main thing is going on is some kind of localization of electrons. But why, to answer your question, why the antiferromagnetism should show up around? I mean, if you localize the system, it might have some more tendency to magnetism.
But still, one has to understand why it happens, where the magnetic ordering happens exactly at the same point. And that's not understood at all. Maybe we don't have to understand it. I don't know, future experiments may tell us. But Anyway, so there are all these questions. So to make contact, what I'm going to say next, one should more or less view the underlying transition, in this case, as a mock localization of the, as a localization transition of this F band. Right? So it's a loss of participation of the F electrons in forming the Fermi liquid. And perhaps, as I said earlier, the magnetic order is a secondary effect, the low energy complication that happens once this localization of the F band has taken place. Once this falling out of the Fermi surface has taken place and the F's no longer are entangled with the conduction electrons and they're just waiting to do something with their spin entropy. But in any case, this general line of thinking tells you that the non-Fermi liquid is perhaps due to the fluctuations associated with the change of electronic structure rather than the dose of magnetic order. Right?
So is there some general reason to believe that? Earlier you were saying that it persists to very high temperature.
Yeah, so I'm going to comment on that. So the promise is this. Right? So we don't know what our understanding of this kind of electronic structure changing phase transition is poor. Right? But it has promise. Because, precisely as you, the question you asked, electronic structure involves electronic energy scales, right? So the effects have the potential to extend to much higher energy scales than, magnetism or loop currents or any of these things, right? So there's the promise, we don't know. And this promise comes with another promise, this sort of discontinuous change of Fermi surface at a continuous phase transition, you're guaranteed to get non-Fermi liquid physics. Right? How can it not be a non-Fermi liquid if this is what's going on? Right? So it's good to work on understanding this. I think all this just to motivate why focusing on this may be a good idea, and this kind of thing may be what's needed to get a description of this unstable t equals zero quantum fixed point for the non-Fermi liquid method. So a simpler example which illustrates some of these same issues is a metal insulator transition in a clean system. Because insulators don't have Fermi surfaces and metals do. Right? So the Fermi surface evolved from a metal. As a metal goes to an insulator, it's got to lose its Fermi surface. Right? So the simplest possibility is that you have a band, a partially filled band, at some Fermi level, and you tune the chemical potential and you just deoccupy that band. Right? So then you go from metal to an insulator and you lose the Fermi surface. What happens here, of course, is the Fermi surface shrinks in size, shrinks to a point, and then you just lose it. Right? So this is the boring, well-understood case. It's not going to solve our problems. We saw, for instance, that the Earth-Alfin frequency did not change, but it just disappeared on us. Right? So the question is more interesting if the insulation is, so this is a band insulator. The insulation is not due to band effects, but rather is a Mott insulator. Okay? So let's think about electrons on some lattice. Yeah?
Just another really naive question. If you're a field theorist and you're handling theory with a gap to charge fluctuations, how do you decide whether it's insulating because it's a band insulator or a Mott insulator? What's the field theory definition in terms of some current correlators or something?
It's an insulator, no. You tell me it's an insulator, it's an insulator. If it's insulating because of interaction effects, if you're a field theorist, you have a Lagrangian.
Right.
So turn off all the non-quadratic terms in your Lagrangian.
I guess I'm asking, do you really believe there's an invariant distinction between band and Mott insulators, or is it a qualitative?
Okay, in the specific instance that I'm going to talk about, there is a clear distinction between a Mott insulator and a band insulator. But as we were just talking this morning, Steve and I, most of us, when we say Mott insulator, we have a more general picture of a Mott insulator, which may not be have a sharp distinction with the band insulator.
The picture I know is half-filling and into a propulsion or something. But
that's right. So that picture is basically correct. Right? Now, in some cases, that can be sharply distinct from a balanced layer. Right? But it doesn't have to be, and this picture would still be correct. It's just common sense. OK. So let's think about how a Fermi liquid may evolve into a molten slater. And let's imagine doing this by keeping the electron density fixed.
Were you saying that there are cases that are known in which you can't continuously evolve a mod insulator into a band insulator?
Yeah, some of them are called these things, you know, topological phases. That's an example, right?
Fair enough.
You know, double transient spin liquids. So you do know them.
I've heard of them.
Yeah, you've heard of them. So yeah.
Okay.
So let's do this at fixed electron density, one per lattice site, and imagine cranking up the on-site propulsion between electrons to go from a Fermi liquid material to a molten slate. The molten slate has no Fermi surface, this has a Fermi surface. Now this Fermi surface, or this Fermi liquid, as it revolves towards the molten slater, it cannot disappear by shrinking and losing size. Right? Because the size of this Fermi surface is fixed by Schrödinger sum rule to correspond to exactly one electron per lattice site. Right? And we're not changing the density. So the area, if you're in two dimensions, two space dimensions, one time dimension, is fixed by the electron density. Right? So we can't shrink it and get rid of it. So the only way to get rid of it is to get rid of it without shrinking it. Yeah?
What if I have compensating electron and hole pockets, and then I just shrink the size of those pockets?
Compensating electron and hole pockets.
What do you want to create next?
So I want to start with the Fermi surface at half filling, which is not nested, and then, you know, do anti-paramagnetism.
That's one way to evolve, absolutely. Where you first develop, let's say, some sort of magnetic order, right, through your transition, and then eventually you go through this sort of shrinking transition. That's certainly one way to evolve, but let's contemplate.
One per site, or per cell, no, one, two per cell.
Exactly. Well, the moment you develop back through a magnetic order, so you're basically giving a scenario for what this question mark may be, and instead of a single direct transition, that it goes first, develops magnetic order, and so on. So let's, for concreteness, think about this question in the particular case of something that is has no ordering of any sort, one of these spin liquid phases. And then the question is very sharply posed. Right? If there's a direct transition between a Fermi liquid and a spin liquid molten slater that doesn't break any symmetries, then the Fermi surface, you have to address the issue of what happens to the Fermi surface, and it's not trivial. Right? So the entire Fermi surface of the material needs to disappear in one shot at such a phase transition. Right? So now let's think about the cube rates once more.
The possibility is that for that reason the transition couldn't exist.
Right, so that is the possibility. Now, I can tell you that the transition can exist because there's at least one example where one can work it out. Right? And empirically, it seems as though there is a transition which is possibly, second order or best weakly first order on a material that, that I'm not going to talk about here. It's a triangular lattice organic based material. So with all this insight, let's just contemplate, let's say do some speculation. So think about the cube rate. So the overdoped state has a large Fermi surface. Large just means that it satisfies Schrödinger theorem with just the number of electrons that 1 minus x affects as the doping unit cell. So the underdoped cube rate, on the other hand, is known to be metallic as for, suppressed superconductivity in a field. The Fermi surface is not quite known. There's a lot of controversy on what the Fermi surface might be. But it's almost certainly very, very different from the overdoped Fermi surface, from this band structure-like Fermi surface. So something big has happened to the electronic structure as you go from here to there. Right? Among other things, I think the pseudo-gaps are opening up and so on. So we have to deal with this issue of the disappearing large Fermi surface, and quite possibly that's going to tell us, that will help us build a theory of this unstable fixed point. So the basic question for theory is, how can this ever happen at all? Right? How can an entire Fermi surface just die without losing its size? Can't lose its size. Right? So it turns out an answer to this question was given a long time ago. So to describe the answer, let me remind you of something more basic. Now, what is the Fermi surface in an interacting Fermi fluid as opposed to a non-interacting one? So the ideal Fermi gas, if you look at the momentum, the occupation number in k-space, everyone knows it has the step discontinuity of 1. So the interacting Fermi fluid, the Landau Fermi liquid, has a modified n of k, but it still has a jump discontinuity, where this jump is traditionally denoted z, is some number smaller than 1. So there's a sharp jump discontinuity. And z is the extent to which the electron overlaps the Landau quasiparticle. It's the, in the electron Green's function, it's the weight of the quasiparticle pole. So how can a Fermi surface die continuously? So the answer, as I said, was actually given in 1970 as a scenario backed up by some crude calculation, that you could have a continuous disappearance of the Fermi surface if this quasiparticle weight z vanishes continuously and everywhere on the Fermi surface. Right? So you lose the Fermi surface by just losing the Landau quasiparticle, so it's not there anymore. Okay. So if I go back to this previous slide, this thing keeps shrinking until it just becomes smooth, as you expect it to be in an insulator. And by now there are concrete examples and various limits, various models that you can work out. Okay. So the crucial question then is, what is the identity? I mean, how are we supposed to think about such a critical point where z has just gone to zero? So the claim that I'll make, based on a very simple argument, is that right at this critical point, the Fermi surface remains sharply defined even though there is no Landau quasiparticle. Right? There's no Landau quasiparticle because z is zero. And this is what I'll call a critical Fermi surface. So the argument is So let's think about the Mott transition. The Mott transition is useful to think about because it gives us conceptually a very simple case to think about for disappearing from surfaces. So let's ask about the gap delta of k to add an electron at momentum k to the system. Right? In the Fermi liquid, this gap is zero so long as k sits right at the Fermi surface that defines the Fermi surface. Now, in the Mott insulator, there's a sharp gap, delta of k, there's a sharp threshold beyond which there's some onset of spectral weight in the electron spectral function for any k, right? So there's the Mott gap. And if the transition were second order, then this Mott gap has to go to zero continuously.
It's just a question about the top Fermi liquid. I mean, if you interacting Fermi liquid.
Yes.
That's a problem. When you add an electron and you make a particle excitation at zero energy,
yeah,
there will be zero everywhere in the entire.
That's true, but the weight will be maximum. There's a dominant singularity in the electron spectral function at the Fermi surface. That's what we mean by the Fermi surface.
No, but in a Fermi liquid, it's well defined. It places a jump discontinuity.
Yeah, the statement so far with the Fermi liquid.
No, but I think the delta is zero everywhere.
As you know, I agree that delta is zero everywhere, but really this is this where there's most weight. It's a dominant singularity. You're worried about me using the dominant singularity. So for instance, this is not the way that I think is most useful, but let me, it's not most useful because Matthew is going to make a comment in 2 minutes. But till he does that, you know, at some intermediate, time scale, it's where you have this jump discontinuity. Now, so for Sean, since you asked me to repeat what he said, you can always add an electron somewhere and then make a particle hole excitation at some arbitrary momentum that the particle and hole is drawn from states near the Fermi surface, and thereby, get some weight in many parts, and if you have a lattice, basically everywhere in K space. Okay? But most of those places will not have this. They will not have the only place where there will be a jump discontinuity, which is so the singularity will be much weaker, in all these other things. And if you more precisely, if you look at A of K and omega, ask where the delta function, that's the delta function peak at zero frequency only at the Fermi surface.
But the question is, in your non-Fermi liquid.
We'll come to that. I think one has to live with that structure, right? Let's discuss that once I complete the argument. But the issue is actually not that different from a 1D Ledger liquid. And
in the 1D Ledger liquid, you don't have the same problem of low energy spectral weight everywhere. It only appears at KF and 3KF.
And if you have a lattice, it's the same.
If you're on a lattice, it's the same.
And we live with that, live with that for 3 decades. So let me complete the argument and then we can discuss this issue. As we approach from the Mott, this Mott gap has to go to zero for the second order transition. And so delta of K will close continuously. Now, to match to the Fermi surface of the metal, we want to make delta of K go to zero for all K belonging to the Fermi surface. Right? So it's in this sense that the Fermi surface is sharp at the critical point, but since Z is zero, there is no sharp quasi-particle, and so what one has is a non-Fermi liquid with a sharp critical Fermi surface. Okay? Now I can...
Don't you want to be saying that you're looking at the spectral function and that it's going to have to be
absolutely
there, so it's got to have a non-analyticity here and
yes,
below. You don't really want to be talking about delta. I mean, otherwise Matthew's going to get you.
No, but the spectral function, it's going to be non-analytic everywhere.
It is, okay.
But there's a dominant singularity.
First place, in the Fermi liquid, it'll only have a jump at the Fermi surface.
Oh, that's fine.
Yeah, and then it'll have higher and higher at criticality. It'll have higher and higher
exactly
everywhere.
Well, I'll tell you a counterexample in the liquid where you get the dominant singularity doesn't give the Lagrange sum.
I know your counterexample, Matthew, but it's the same issue that exists in 1D Lagrange liquids. So I'm not it's the same complication that we have to deal with in 1D. Okay? So if you wish, that's the structure of the theory. There's KF surface and then you can make, add 2KF things and make other things, and that's the theory. Right? That's known from liquid.
It's a known from liquid if there's no moment, jump discontinuity and momentum distribution function.
Yeah.
That you can all agree on, but I mean, defining a sharp surface or a unique sharp surface isn't problematic.
Yeah, no, it's as problematic as 1D Lagrange liquid.
Exactly.
Yeah, sure. But okay. We've lived with that before. And surely there'll be very exotic states in which the dominant singularity doesn't happen at this Fermi surface. Just like in 1D, you have to try very hard to produce such states. Right? You manage to produce, but there are zillions of Lagrange liquids that people have studied mostly don't have that concern.
Yeah, they're sort of weak coupling, in a sense. Right? They're sort of just evolving out of the free fermions.
Yeah, so this is, you know, it's at a critical point. If I'm in a non-forming liquid phase, I might, eventually one may have to worry about such things, but let's take the first sort of step, right? And this is very close, it's at a critical point of forming liquid. Right?
Well, you actually have a theory when you do something, right?
Yeah, so... but I'm not, mostly not going to talk about that in the remaining, what, minus 5 minutes or something. So there will be situations, there are concrete situations in which the dominant single atom is indeed at the surface. Future Matthew may find situations in which it's more complicated than that. But we'll worry about that when the time comes. Anyway, so that's the point I've already made. Since I'm running out of time, let me sort of quickly make a few comments. So why is there this distinction of Fermi surface, right? So it's related to the competition between Mott physics and electron delocalization. Right? And many of these materials, many of the interesting low energy phenomena happen when neither tendency is overwhelmingly dominant. Right? When they're both fighting each other. And so it's natural, perhaps, that these phenomena emerge from a universal mother fixed point where this basic competition critically destroys from its surface. Okay. So this is clearly a hard problem, right? And it'll be useful if you were to follow this route, which I think is well motivated, to have some concrete results on simple models which we can understand. No, those are too complicated. So more effective. Even more effective than that. So let me briefly tell you what we've been able to do so far, which is not much. But it's useful because it's at least, you know, one concrete set of calculations that one can do, where one can demonstrate some of these things. So there's only one currently available theoretical framework to address questions of this sort. In two or higher dimensions. And that goes in the name of slate particles or partons or whatever. The idea is to view the electron as a composite of slate particles of the fractional quantum numbers and reformulate the original electron model in terms of the slate particles interacting through gauge forces. And the gauge forces that come in because of redundancy that's built in into such a slate particle description. There's surely many of you familiar with the basic philosophy of the slate particle thing. So using this framework, one can describe concrete examples of phase transitions where an entire Fermi surface disappears continuously. Right? So I can demonstrate there's a critical Fermi surface, that there's known Fermi liquids that emerge, and so on. Right? So it's useful in that it's at least one example that one can work things out and understand. So it's important as proof of principle, but you know, it's too early for, I mean, we shouldn't jump up and down and say we've explained the experiments in the heavy fermions or the cuprates, because it's missing lots of things. You know, these kinds of things can't deal with. I'll talk briefly about what we're missing. So as an example, let me just put up one phase diagram of an example of a continuous Mott transition between a metal and a spin-liquid Mott insulator in two dimensions. So you can work on a number of things about this critical point and the finite temperature crossover sort of it. It turns out it's somewhat different from what one might have naively imagined. There are two distinct crossovers. Which are parametrically different, say on the metallic side. And if you're sitting on the metallic side, you go from this quantum critical non-Fermi liquid which is controlled by whatever fixed point controls this, through a semi-quantum marginal Fermi-liquid metal, that electron spectral function has exactly its marginal Fermi-liquid form before crossing over into a Fermi-liquid metal. And so on. So there's all kinds of things that you can do. And the theory for this sort of Fermi surface disappearing, for this particular Fermi surface disappearing transition, cannot be described in terms of this Fermi surface plus X, where X is some bosonic gapless fluctuation. It's outside that framework. So the last 2 years, we've worked on a number of similar models for dissection of Fermi surfaces, which can be studied in various contexts. When you do chemical potential tuned versions, and go by changing the density from a spin liquid molten state for metal, go to three dimensions, one can do study phase transitions and condor lapses where this kind of thing happens. And Catherine's been working on that, extracting further physics from this kind of approach. But in all these examples, when the electronic Fermi surface has disappeared, the resulting phase doesn't have an electron Fermi surface as seen in photo emission. But it still has a ghost Fermi surface of fractionalized slave particles. Right? So only part of the Fermi surface has really disappeared. Just that if you're doing a photo emission experiment, it would seem as though the full thing has disappeared. If you measure, say, spin correlation, look at 2kF or something, they survive both in both phases. So in some sense, Fermi surface disappeared, but in some other senses, it's only partly disappeared. It has a ghostly existence. So this is the only kind of state that I think we can access within the slave particle framework without basically getting rid of slave particles, without doing confinement or something, and then we don't know what the heck is going on. So we probably need to go beyond this framework, describe situations where these ghost Fermi surfaces do not survive. And certainly, at the semi fermion phase transitions, for instance, except perhaps for this example which I said was only likely, except perhaps for that, there's no evidence that any of these exotic things survive. So both phases are conventional. Right? So the case where you can work things out, at least one of the phases is unconventional. And the chip rates too, there's very little evidence, but that may change, that at zero temperature, any of the phases we have is really unconventional. So we have to solve a more challenging problem for which we don't have a framework. So we need to go beyond. I don't think we can push this, move this any further to describe this kind of fixed point. But I mean, I'm happy to be proven wrong. And so I don't have to learn anything else. Anyway, so let me stop there.
The phase diagram you describe a slave particle, like AD field, so it's exact in certain limit or?
No. At least not for the particular example that I showed you. But as for the critical properties are concerned, it doesn't have to be exact. So it turns out, surprisingly enough, that even though this looks like complicated theory, Fermi surface gauge field is a critical boson the slave boson that's trying to condense. Despite all that complication, it turns out the theory is stackable, and one can study the universal critical properties. It's a lucky accident.
So what is disputed in the experiments, Italian versions, silicon versus the medium and cobalt?
Yeah.
What is the dispute? Because I think it was accepted now by the community that we can disentangle the magnetism and weird stuff.
I don't know about the community. I would like it to. I would like more experiments, not that much. It's not been probed as much as it should be. Maybe they're told that, but they're not telling people, right? I mean, telling, you know, making it publicly available. But the published evidence isn't that strong. So it's tantalizing, but it's not strong.
Let's finish with this point. Maybe
yeah.
I don't know what the